Yeehaw, we're back with an all new episode of Keep It. I'm Cowboy Madison.
I'm rootin' tootin' Grand Slam Breakfast Louis Fertel. And we're not alone this time at the Hootenanny. We have a third cast member today, Crooked Media's esteemed authoress, an amazing author, by the way, but also maybe a more amazing podcaster, the fabulous Kendra James. Hi.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I am so excited. I have been two-stepping for this three-day weekend.
I am excited, too. I really like this album. I have some thoughts. We'll get into all of it. Obviously, this is the Cowboy Carter episode. I was already harangued on social media that this episode had better just be about the album.
To be fair, I don't even know what else would be offered up. Yeah, this was pop culture this weekend.
JoJo Siwa's rebrand.
I did see that. That did get into my algorithm.
It won't be her last.
Yeah, she was at the iHeart Awards last night with Beyonce, who, honestly, this is such a fun era to me. I mean, a lot of people have compared it to I Am Sasha Fierce. Just because, you know, first of all, it's a sprawling album. It's long as hell. It is 27 tracks. It is about 79 minutes. And it feels long in the same way that I Am Sasha Fierce was a very long double disc. And it's also a very accessible throwback era for her. Like, she popped up at the iHeart Awards last night to get the Innovator Award from Stevie Wonder, where she revealed that he was playing the harmonica on Jolene.
How many secret fucking reveals can this album have?
That's been... I have no criticisms, really, for this album, aside from the fact that I have been sitting around having to guess where I'm thinking I'm hearing people because there are not full credits out.
Right.
There are partial credits on Tidal, but it doesn't have, like, who's playing what. And that's what I want to give these people their flowers. But right. We'll get into it.
But it's like, give these people. It's like thousands and thousands of people. Like,
right.
Like it's longer than any Beyonce Vogue rap could possibly entail.
I think also there's a big issue with the album where the vinyls were pressed weeks ago, and now the vinyls have arrived and it does not have Yaya on it, the Linda Martell show. It does not have Flamenco, which is perfectly fine, and it doesn't have O Louisiana on it. And this is a problem that has popped up in vinyls recently. You know, Nicki Minaj had her album pressed on vinyl and it was missing several tracks. And then Ariana Grande's Eternal Sunshine was also missing vocals on the song Supernatural. So this is a problem that is popping up lately, mostly because people are printing the vinyls earlier than the album is being available on digital. And it's very evident that these artists, particularly Beyonce, have been working on the album until the last possible minute, which is kind of unusual for her, I feel like. But a lot of people mentioned that they were laying down vocals or they were mixing things for this album up to like a week before it was released. So she was tinkering with the final project of Act Two right before it was supposed to come out. Even the vinyls and the CD have the original title, Beyonce,
yeah,
on it. It does not say Cowboy Carter anywhere except for a sticker, which is put onto the vinyls and the CD.
And people are really upset about this. I've been spending a lot of time in the subreddit this
weekend.
They're
pressed.
They're really upset.
Like a vinyl.
Yeah, much like. And for me, I kind of like, I get it. You're upset. You wanted your full thing. But if you read the website description, there was no track list when we ordered this thing. There was no promise of a bonus poster. There was no promise of anything aside from you're getting some sort of vinyl pressing. And so I'm not super upset. This feels so close to a misprint, just due to the packaging also being wrong, which says to me that I'm just like, well, I'm going to buy the real one when it comes out. And I'm going to not take the plastic off of this, and it's going to be worth some money in 4 years.
Yeah, it's like having the postage stamp with the upside-down airplane on it or whatever. It's like, well, one day I'll put this on whatever super post-apocalyptic eBay is and then make $1 trillion.
Yeah.
They made a 9/11 stamp.
Oh, that's your joke on that? Okay. Enjoy Comedy Central in 2003.
Get me on midnight.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's very funny that this is being taken this way, because it almost feels in a way like, not to invoke his name, I'm so sorry, but Kanye-esque, if you recall, particularly The Life of Pablo, mm-hmm. where people kept making jokes where it kept changing and then adding and taking things away from the streaming version. Beyonce at least hasn't done that. The album is out and she's not tinkering with the streaming version. And honestly, I feel like maybe she even just announced the album date and was like, this is going to make me stop working on it. Because it was supposed to be, we know that she's this perfectionist Virgo. We've seen too many documentaries where she is down to the right light bulb. This needs to be perfect. And we also know that from interviews that this was supposed to be act one,
right?
Originally. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about that now. It was originally supposed to be act one. She recorded all of these projects, started them during COVID, like 2020-ish, 2019. And she was originally going to release this as act one, but after the pandemic, she decided that people, you know, really needed to dance, you know, they needed to boogie on down to the discotheque. That's when we got Renaissance first. And honestly, good for her. Because if this album had been released first, I do not know how well it would have been received.
Especially as the beginning of like a trilogy. Like if we thought this was the first chapter, because I feel like this is a good intro. You know what it's like? Back to the Future Part 3. Oh, we'll take a stop at the Old West, but it's not the whole story, you know?
And it definitely is her leading into, I guess, perceptions of her, perceptions of what we thought this album was going to be. We kept saying, this is the country album. This is the country album. And she sort of helped along with that by releasing Texas Hold'em, by releasing 16 Carriages, having them labeled as country on iTunes. And then she was like, well, it's not a country album. It's a Beyonce album. And now listening to it, I would more classify this album as a Western, not country.
I've been calling it Americana in my head, just like overall Americana. And I will say this era of hers, of these acts, it does seem to be the era where we're just going to release the singles that tell you absolutely nothing about what the album is actually going to sound like.
Right. No, it's I would compare it to Taylor Swift in that way when, you know, Shake It Off comes out and then the rest of the album is a completely sonically different situation. Yeah, I might also add the word outlaw to how I would describe it because it's more like, yeah, there's like a cinematic Western atmosphere to the album, but there's not much, like nothing sounds, for example, like, and I'm not saying anybody thought the album would sound like this, Shania Twain. Like everything is more like folk and vintage with then newer styles introduced kind of alongside the Peckinpah atmosphere of the album.
Yeah, and it's overall also like, this is her most violent album, I would say, which I find to be very interesting. She's killing people.
She's psychotic.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Daughter is a deranged song. But we're getting ahead of ourselves because this is just the intro. This is just our Keep It Requiem.
Yes. Okay? If you will. Yes.
Nothing really ends.
Yeah.
Yes. It is. It's exciting to have Kendra here. We're going to get into the full album. We also have Justice Smith here this week. An amazing actor. I love him.
Very psyched to talk to Justice Smith.
Yes. And it is also very weird to be sitting here. I'm back in New York recording this because I was truly just in LA for the last one. And then I did a bunch of segments and videos with Kendra. And then I came back to New York. And then I saw Lewis in New York.
Yes. We were at Horse Meat Disco, which is just a colossal apocalyptic gayscape where... You just, you walk in and you're immediately like there's sweat on you like laminate immediately. But I was having a wonderful time and, you know, making friends, if you will.
That's what we're calling it.
Yeah, so right. Okay. Sounds like how they would report on it in the police blotter in the 70s. A bunch of gays were out making friends last night. Where was your family?
You know, I will say, not to get into the horse beat of it all, but it's at the Knockdown Center, and I love the Knockdown Center, but there needs to be something done about the floats in that place. The specific part on the right side, it is giving fire hazard.
You know what it reminds me of in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles when there's the underground skate park and arcade zone where you can go, but it's also like caked with smoke because in those days people just smoked inside. But anyway, it just has that weird where am I atmosphere. How is there this much room in this city, etc.
How are y'all both doing? I can't do this anymore. I have not seen the sunrise in Hell's Kitchen since I was like 24.
I was fully home by 3. Oh, no, yeah, okay. I have a ceiling. I cannot do sleep deprivation. And by the way, also before I begin, I just want to say, mysteriously yesterday, I was in a terrible car accident. I was T-bone driving home. I am completely fine. I am not injured at all. But I want to say I was discombobulated afterwards. It was a crazy feeling. You don't know what to do. You're wondering if you're okay. And I just want to say that headspace is exactly right for beginning Traitors Australia season 2, which is only for people who have recently been concussed. Oh my God. Yet? They are the zaniest cast I have ever seen. It is immediately laughable and only gets crazier. So I'm just saying, if you've suffered some, kind of debilitating moment, all hope is not lost for you. You're ready for reality TV.
Did they add season 2 of Australia to Peacock?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, because I was waiting for... I hate using a VPN, to be honest, and I only use it to watch Survivor Australia, but I've been getting people into season 2 of UK, because that's been on Peacock for
which
a few weeks.
Which is fabulous.
If you think that this is like Beyonce's most violent album, Traitors season 2, UK... You would think the traitors are actually murdering people the right. way that this cast is acting. There's one traitor yes. who is truly psychotic.
And also, by the way, again, it's just a role in a game you are assigned. There's nothing actually, quote unquote, psychotic about what's happening. And the way people get into character is frightening. You know?
Internalized.
Yes, right.
Yeah, the Phaedra Parks method.
Yeah, precisely.
And honestly, the way that people who are faithfuls talk about morality in the game of traitors as if it could have been you who was tapped and become a traitor at the beginning of the game.
No, they truly think of themselves as victims as opposed to game show contestants.
Okay, I'm very excited that Australia season 2 is on Peacock, so I will be watching that. I also want to do a quick shout out to Deal or No Deal Island.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
For the girls who are familiar with Deal or No Deal, obviously, you know, there's the banker, there's the... there's the ladies with the briefcases, and you're basically just picking random briefcases and seeing how much money is in them. And then the banker will make you a deal, and you have to guess if he's bluffing you or if there's more or less in your suitcase. Deal or No Deal Island is like Survivor meets Deal or No Deal. Everyone is living on this island, and they compete in challenges. And then the person who gets the highest amount in a briefcase is immune, and then they decide between the two people who have the lowest amount who is going to play the banker's game. Mm. And when that person wins, they get to select whoever they want to be eliminated, except for the immune person. But if they lose, they have to leave the island. And I was immediately drawn in because Boston Rob is on this show.
Oh, I didn't realize they were working with a familiar pool.
Oh, yeah, I did not know that.
Yes, Boston Rob. Well, it's all random new people except for Boston Rob and Claudia Jordan.
What, excuse me?
Yes,
Toes
Claudia
herself?
Jordan. Yes, she is on it, and she keeps her whole thing is she's talking about how she has experience playing this because she used to be one of the Deal or No Deal briefcase models.
Right, right.
Oh, excuse me, which is like you're Vanna White, basically. That is unbelievable.
It's like Vanna,
you don't even know
like
what's
Vanna
in the
White.
Briefcase when you're holding it. Yeah,
right. It's like Vanna White coming to Wheel of Fortune and saying, I know this game like the back of my hand.
Yeah. How did JoJo Siwa's rebrand get across my algorithm and Claudia Jordan living on an island didn't? Something's very wrong.
I have no idea. But I think I'm like officially Peacock Hive.
I guess
okay,
so, too.
I love
Traitors.
Peacock.
Oh, excuse me. When I ran out of Traitors, I literally started watching old Project Runway episodes so that I could stick around Peacock in case more Traitors happened. I just wanted to be nearby.
Just wanted to make sure the app worked.
Yeah.
Since Days of Our Lives moved to Peacock and left NBC, I obviously watch it every day. I think we needed some sort of soap opera Traitors, to be honest, or mix some of them in there.
Yeah, why not?
You know, Eileen Davidson popping over.
I would love Eileen Davidson on Traitors, because if you think Housewives are being over the top, give us some soap actors on The Traitors, auditioning to get back on whatever show that they've been cut from.
Well, by the way, once upon a time, you could count on Big Brother cast members, at least one per season, getting like a quick role on The Bold and the Beautiful or something. And I mm-hmm. love that trashy pipeline. Just, I think that's kind of where they belong. So let's keep that going.
Yeah. So I am firmly pro Deal or No Deal Island, but I do want to let you know that like the normal people on there are truly like Midwest yokels.
Mm. My people? Oh, you're saying representation matters. Okay, very good.
All right. So when we are back, we are going to dive into Cowboy Carter track by track, just how you want it.
Well, women in New York City are getting punched in the face, figure skaters are doing backflips, and TikTok is horny for George W. Bush. Is it all connected? Only if you're listening to the latest episode of Terminally Online. Can I cancel you guys myself?
I sat down with John Lovett and producers Caroline Reston and Kendra James to get to the bottom of the internet's bottomless horrors. And longtime Keep It listeners, you may want to listen because Caroline comes in with some beef.
Oh, get the hell out. Well, to listen, make sure you subscribe to Friends of the Pod at crooked.com/friends.
Okay, so this album starts out with a song, American Requiem. And because it's Act Two, all of the song titles with an I have a double I in
right.
them, which is part of the Act Two-ness of it all, but I also feel like it's part of her drawl, if you choose to pronounce it that way.
I also think she just wants us fighting with autocorrect all weekend. Excuse me, the battles I have waged against my phone for this woman, just to explain my feeling about a song.
When you're typing the song titles to people, Kendra, do you add the extra I?
I have been, because that's the way she wanted it. And
right.
So I respect that.
I stopped.
All right. Well, someone's not
high. And with Riverdance, it's just two words. Okay. My iPhone does not need to know the full word Riverdance. Okay. I'm not invoking Michael Flatley. We'll get to that. Yeah. But American Requiem is how we open up the album. And we know that Beyonce loves an intro. She loves an overture. This is very Pray You Catch Me from Lemonade. It's dramatic and it's solemn. And then it gets into, I guess, the theme of the album. It discusses the CMA's incident and how she was really sort of angered and propelled into making this project.
I mean, I saw this track. First of all, I think it's her best opening track on any of the 8 albums, hands down. And I saw it really as, this is a thesis statement. Because as you're saying, it doesn't name the CMAs, which, by the way, have we had proof of life from the CMAs since this dropped?
Yeah, right.
I have not seen a peep. I have not heard from anyone. Like, are they cowering? Where are they?
We're not their core demo, to be sure. So
right,
it's possible we don't know.
I've been click-clacking around. I've been looking.
Okay.
Has anyone checked the Klan rallies?
No, but yeah, it's the clearest thesis that she has ever laid out about an album. And it really tells you from the lyrics to the style of music that it goes throughout the song. It tells you exactly what you're getting from this album. You're hearing sort of that 70s guitar, you're hearing a lot of Beatles influence, I felt like, which you're getting obviously straight into the next track, but then also in other places throughout the album. It's rare that a first song is like one of my favorites, but the more I have thought about it this weekend, American Requiem like firmly slots into at least my top 5, I think, on this album.
And in fact, if that song weren't there, the album would suffer because there's
yes.
so many directions on this album that you almost need like a compass at the beginning
mm-hmm.
to tell you, well, it's going to go all these different places. In fact, I would say the most surprising thing about this album is because as I experience it, country feels like one particular thing. The amount of influences that are not country are very surprising.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like I would never expect to hear the Beatles in any form on this album. And yet it's like, oh, I guess picking Blackbird has country in it or whatever. Like the moment in Ya Ya with Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. It's like, who knew she cared? You know, it's like, it's very interesting, like what she... I mean, because obviously she's performing to the nth on this. The vocals are so masterfully done. Some of her best vocals ever. But at the same time, it's like just like on Renaissance, she is moving between so many roles. It's like, it is didactic. She's literally stepping aside from being a star to be like, these other things have mattered before me. They will matter after me. And I'm going to work with them and also do my own thing. So there's just a lot of explaining and strategizing, as well as simply being Beyonce on the album.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of homework with the album.
Well, let me say something about exactly that word, which is sometimes it feels like, oh, she did the homework. And then occasionally it feels like homework.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I felt very much like that episode of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, where Will and Carlton are the two black kids in Aunt Viv's African-American studies class, and she reprimands them for not working as hard as the white students to learn about what's going on. It felt very much like I put on Ariana Grande's album again on Sunday because I needed a break. I just needed to bop to Ponytail again. And then I felt like a knock at my door, and it was Beyonce.
In her headmistress outfit.
And she said, I gave you Tyrant.
Excuse me, the pop quiz is on Tuesday. You're recording. But no, I mean, it doesn't feel arduous in that homework way the entire time. But there are definitely tracks, there are definitely moments where you're feeling like, you're feeling the burn. You're feeling like you are really the strain of your brain trying to figure out what she was doing here. And I think a lot of that is also lending it to the fact that we didn't get the full credits immediately. We didn't know things like Stevie Wonder is doing the harmonica on Jolene. It made me have to run that track back, okay? Mm-hmm. Because Jolene is not one of my favorites on here. And we'll get to that one. But American Requiem, Into Blackbird, I love that song. I love that song in general from the Beatles. I think it's a beautiful song. I love that it has the reference to the Little Rock Nine. And I feel like that's obviously why she picked this song. It's beautiful. I think it would be amazing if she had done it on tour, if it were this live rendition of Blackbird from Beyonce that you constantly play back at parties or something, or when you're just at home wanting to listen to, you know, Beyonce's great covers. Like, I was listening to her cover of Sex on Fire, you know, the other day, listening to her do Alanis. Like, that is fun to watch, a live rendition of it. For the album, for me, I've been skipping it.
It's also a weird second track. You know, after the major quality of American Requiem, going into what I would call basically a conventional cover of Blackbird. Mm-hmm. Like, it actually, to me, sounds like the Sarah McLachlan cover from I Am Sam a little bit.
And I think we do know, we don't know, but we can certainly suspect that that's one of the ones that was added quite late.
Yeah.
Because that, so Tanner Adele is one of the vocalists on that album. She's a black country girl. She had a song called Buckle Bunny. A single.
Amazing song. She references Beyonce on it.
She's been calling herself the Beyonce of country for a minute now. And I like her as a person. I think she's really fun. I like watching her TikToks. I love watching her. Like, I was just watching a few clips of her performing in London. She's really fun interacting with the crowd, explaining like American references. Buckle Bunny did not do it for me. I think Buckle Bunny needed a few more crosses with a producer. I don't like the way it sounds. I like the idea of it. I just think it needed something else. But I really like her. And I'm really glad that she's getting this exposure right now, because I think she is going to be a very important part of country.
And all the voices on this particular cover sound great, by the way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you need to take one of Cody Rigsby's Peloton classes, because it sounds great when you're on a Peloton bike. And I also want to say about the Tanner Adele of it all, my friend Brendan Holder was reminding us in our group chat that we were fully clowning Tanner Adele in February because she was tweeting out, I really want a Beyonce feature. I want to be on a Beyonce track. And people were responding to her like, maybe you need to work on that craft, baby. And it was fully like people were making fun of her. And then she was vindicated when she ended up on Cowboy Carter. But from the tweets and from how she was referencing still wanting to get on a Beyonce track, I just know that NDA is strong.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So that tells me that she was added to the song recently.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's almost certainly the
case. I'm never going to clown a woman for tweeting what she wants. That's how I ended up at Shondaland. I DM'd that woman.
That said, I am uncomfortable with the idea that Beyonce or someone near her is reading Twitter. Just stay away. Don't. It's garbage.
Oh, no. She is so active. She knows everything that's going on. When she did that last year, when she had that TikTok of her and Jay-Z and was using that viral sound, like, I'm on my way to see my husband. It's like she sees everything. I want to see her burner, and I want to know who she follows.
Yeah, and if she's not seeing it, Mama Tina is certainly sending those links along.
Right.
Because she sees everything.
You need Mama Tina on Terminally Online, okay? Right. Because she does not turn her phone off.
Ira. I will be passing that along.
I'm still not over Tina saying that she's had some of these tracks on her phone for years or something. I was like, don't let us peek behind the curtain. We're like, there's a curated show going on, Tina. The House of Darion has no windows.
You can't tell her anything.
So after this, we have 16 Carriages. How do we feel about 16 Carriages in the context of the album?
In the context of the album, exciting. It has that outlaw quality that I think permeates the album. I do tend to skip the song.
Same.
It's been with us for a minute.
Yeah.
I haven't been skipping it because I love the way it goes into Protector. And I feel like that song for me is kind of the start of a really interesting storytelling run that I like. I tend to see 16 Carriages does feel like it is a lot about Beyonce's past. But because Protector to me seems like it's more from her mother Tina's perspective. I'm sort of starting to see 16 Carriages as a little bit like that as well, because with the album probably very likely having originally been called Beyoncé, I think this was a tribute to her mother in the way that Renaissance was a tribute to Uncle Johnny. And so with that in mind, I have started to see a lot of the songs as more from that perspective, not verbatim. I'm not saying this is life. If you read the artist statement that Beyoncé released, she does fully acknowledge that a lot of this is an exaggerated character. I wish people would stop saying that all these songs are about Jay-Z. She does not always have to write just from what she knows. But because of that, and because of that perspective, 16 Carriages has taken on a little bit of a new meaning for me. And so I do listen to it because I like the flow.
I just want to say in general that I find people obsessive about who a female artist is writing about, because I feel like it's a way to recontextualize a song to just talk about men again.
Right.
You know, and it's like just to stay in a conversation about this, like it's the obsession with who You're So Vain is about, or you ought to know is about. It's like, you're not talking about what she has written. You're like mythologizing the fact that she is hurt by a man. That's right.
I mean, even in the Ariana Grande context, right, there were all those memes about how The Boy Is Mine is about Ethan Slater. And she talks in her Zane Lowe interview about how she just wanted to write a bad girl anthem because her fans love that. And also, she's stolen many a man. So,
Plenty of candidates.
I choose to believe it's about Big Sean.
Okay.
Okay? But she stole him from Santana.
Who, I should say, you got lost in the shuffle. That Tiny Desk concert, excellent.
Yes.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. But you know what? That's a big-ass desk. Have you ever thought about that?
Right. I think about my desk and it's tinier than that desk, which makes me feel so inadequate.
And there are so many people in there. How do you get invited to a Tiny Desk concert, by the way?
I don't know, but I think this album should be one.
Yes.
I have never in my life thought that that woman should march herself to DC to do anything like that. This album would be perfect.
That said, they should really do it up like a saloon. And by the way, I did come up with the pun Saloonge Knowles this weekend. Does that speak to anybody?
I hate you.
Okay. Moving along.
Get the fuck out of here. Yeah. Honestly, I was going to say, with the getting ahead of myself to Act 3, you said that Renaissance is a tribute to Uncle Johnny. This feels like a tribute to her mom. If it's going to be rock music, I definitely feel like Act 3 has to be a tribute to Solange, the sister.
Yeah.
We get the sister album. Because
mm-hmm.
I feel like all of her rock and indie influences have come from Solange.
By the way, the Carters-like album where it's just a Beyoncé-Solange duets album, I mean, that would be also fabulous, right?
I'll take
That'd
it.
That'd be sexy as hell. Yeah. Okay? Protector, also a skip for me. Honestly, my amended version of this album, it goes from American Requiem into My Rose. And I love the sound on My Rose. I love how she changes her tone on it. And because I love My Rose going straight into Smoke Hour with Willie Nelson. And I am a little bit disappointed that Willie Nelson is only on the album in a speaking role as the sort of person on the radio, but I do understand it. And I love the beginning of Smoke Hour where the stations are changing and you're hearing, you know, some Rosetta Tharpe, you're hearing some Chuck Berry. It's definitely a fun song, and it adds to the vibe of the album feeling like it's sort of, you know, you're listening to a jukebox, like you're driving around, like you're sprawling through the Old West.
Okay, first of all, I need you to give Protector another chance. Maybe one of my favorite vocals she's ever done. I listen to that song and cry. I find that to just be so beautiful. In terms of the jukebox feeling, like, I definitely agree. For me, one of my dreams has been to do what's billed as the largest yard sale in the country. It starts in Detroit, and then it goes, like, all the way down some highway into the South. And for me, listening to this album is like driving that road and sort of just like having a car where the Bluetooth and the CD player are broken, and you are just forced to listen to the radio. And you're listening to country stations, and the music is changing based on the location that you're in. Maybe, like, at the top of Levi's jeans, I think you hear a... you hear like a cassette being inserted. And so, like, maybe that's just a cassette tape that you've picked up at like a local gas station or something where you pulled over. And I think that's what's so beautiful about it. It is, like we've said, it's not quite country. It feels Americana, outlawish. And it's just taking you on this journey through what American country music can be. And that's just like what I've taken away from it.
And by the way, you just mentioned the Chuck Berry and Rosetta Tharpe of it all. I mean, like, name one other artist of any genre who would slam those both into like a song. Mm. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's a remarkable achievement and idea. It's just like to put both those people. Also, it's like Rosetta Tharpe, still a name people don't know. Like, it's, again, she's doing the didactic thing and for the most part doing it extremely organically. It's just extremely impressive.
Yeah.
I want to compare it a bit to High Fidelity in a way, just in the sense of Beyonce lately has felt like the really cool chick in the record store who's, you know, putting you on some game whenever you come in. Like, you're going in because, you know, like, it's like me. Like, I used to go in and pick up a Bee Gees vinyl or something and be like, I really like this. And there was a person in the record store who was like, well, have you listened to Andy, their brother, you know? So, like, that is, like, how I got into Andy Gibb, who I love more than the Bee Gees.
I don't know about that. Thank you, though.
You don't like Andy Gibb?
I love Andy Gibb, but then the Bee Gees aren't the Bee Gees.
I think I like Andy Gibb more than the Bee Gees because I am obsessed with Andy Gibb's story. It's a very tragic personal story, and I think that, like, the story of him attaches to me more than his lore. Okay, I'm obsessed with his allure.
Okay, very good. Yes, it'll make a fine biopic, which I think just got a different director or something once again.
Yes. But then we get into Texas Hold'em, which also sounds so much better to me in the context of...
Definitely. Yes. Especially with the radio-y intro that we get from Willie Nelson, which, by the way, is a something that I've heard on albums before. There's a Carpenters album where they do a quick hit of all these old songs from the 50s. And it's like that. I love that feeling, too, just because how often are people even listening to the radio anymore? So just to remind people that it even exists is very nice. And also, you remember I did this math this weekend where now Beyonce and Dolly Parton both have connections to Willie Nelson, which means he's probably the auburn-haired muse of Jolene. That is probably what it is.
He fucking Jay-Z? Yeah.
Everybody needs a redheaded stranger. That's all I know.
Beyonce arriving home, sniffing the air. Is that marijuana?
It's not my strand.
Willie back? Hey there, keeping listeners. When we're back, more about Cowboy Carter.
Hey,
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no-bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. And with all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to. Journalists, politicians, experts, comedians and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
I think that after Texas Hold'em, though, is when we get into the album that I want to listen to, okay? That is when the album gets cunt.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that is Bodyguard. Bodyguard is
I agree. It's my favorite
fucking song.
Yeah.
Yes.
It feels very Tapestry. It feels very folk music. Like it
Fleetwood
feels like
Mac,
a classic.
It feels like Christine McVie Fleetwood Mac to me. Yeah.
It is a classic pop vocal.
Yeah. We didn't get full album credits until about 5 minutes before we started recording. But when I tell you, I knew Rafael Sadiq was all over that fucking track. I don't know if you're not familiar with Rafael Sadiq. He's been a fixture in the music industry. And he produced Cuff It off of Renaissance as well. He has two albums. One of them is called Stone Rolling that he did solo. This sounds like it could be all over Stone Rolling. And so if you like this song, you need to go listen to that whole album, plus the one that he did before. He is genuinely like one of our just musical treasures that everyone should be incredibly familiar with. Also, go listen to his group from the 90s, Lucy Pearl.
I also wanted to say this song sounds to me a little bit like, you know, this Jackson Brown song, Somebody's Baby? She Must Be Somebody's Baby. It sounds a little bit like that too, but like that pan 70s pop rock vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also want to say, if you don't know Rafael Sadiq, listen to Tasty by Khalees. He is all over that album.
Oh,
yeah.
Gosh.
Mary J. Blige. He's fantastic. Also, another person who worked on this song was Ryan Beatty, who I adore. He worked on 3 songs on this album. It's a gay singer, songwriter.
Not one of Warren and Annette's kids. That's Ella Beatty, who I saw in the play Appropriate this weekend. I'm sorry, I'm getting them all confused.
I could tell the Bodyguard had a little sweetness to it. Okay. Let's just say that. And he also worked on Two Hands to Heaven. The songs that feel a little tender, sexy. I feel like those are definitely things that feel very Ryan Beatty-ish. So if you like these songs, you will also probably like his music.
Julius is going to get no rest at these concerts. No rest. The girls are going to be all over him.
And now, of course, comes the introduction of Dolly Parton, who, of course, comes right on. I saw somebody on Twitter say it sounds like Jay-Z literally bought her a cameo from Dolly Parton.
Yes.
But she is never going to like do anything spoken word without any kind of Bruce Valanche style quipping going on. And that's what you get her saying, like, oh, you had a problem with a girl with hair? Well, I had a problem with a girl with hair, too. Isn't that something? Okay, here comes a song. Like, wow, Dolly is just really on brand. The same she has been since, whatever, 9 to 5 before.
Hey, Miss Honeybee, it's Dolly P. You know that hussy with the good hair you sing about? Hearing her say hussy sent me to the moon.
Which is Dionne Warwick culture, as you know. Yeah. Yes.
Some of your better accent work there.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Thank you.
The lightest you. Working, and most damning praise. Yes.
I will say, though, Jolene is not a hit for me.
I would call it a creative writing exercise. Yes. That maybe should have stayed in the notebook.
I think much like Blackbird, they are both great songs because they are great vocals. She has produced the hell out of them. I think just in the context of this album, both songs are a lot less exciting because we have all of this new music to absorb. And then we're just getting these two songs that we are very familiar with.
Yes.
And she did more with Jolene than she did with Blackbird to like make it her own. But were they not on the album, I wouldn't be like, sad.
Also, sometimes when like an artist is covering someone, they're attempting to put a twist on the song or bring out qualities that maybe the original version doesn't. I think the problem here is what she is doing, adding like this kind of devastation and kind of bubbling under hurt. It already is in the song. I feel like, you know, I have a problem with the, I'm going to bring them up again, Carpenters. There's a Carpenters tribute album called If I Were a Carpenter, where it's like grittier version. Sonic Youth's famous cover is on that album. And it's like, these songs were already dark. You didn't have to add a rock vocal to make it dark. You know what I mean? So that's sort of my bone to pick with this.
Now, what I will say is that it does, again, this storytelling flow flows into Daughter perfectly.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I can't be mad about that, because then you get to Daughter and the perspective completely flips.
True, but I will say that Bodyguard into Daughter also feels the same. You know, mm-hmm. I'll be your bodyguard. I also really like how that song, going back to Bodyguard, flips the protector role from a woman protecting a man. And then you get into Daughter, and she is, this is the, Daughter is the sequel to Daddy's Lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my daddy said, shoot, and when you get to Daughter, she's covered in blood.
Yep.
All
she,
right.
She is ditching the weapon and she is running for the police. I love Daughter. Daughter almost feels like it is the sequel to the telephone video.
Mm. Yes, yes, yes. And yeah. I'm looking forward to, we haven't gotten to the song yet, but Two Most Wanted. I hope we get a Miley and Beyonce like Thelma and Louise-ery going on. That would be mm-hmm. nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lastly, I just want to say about Jolene, I think that what really works for me is that it feels like a blaxploitation version of Jolene, as Doreen St. Felix called it in her excellent review in The New Yorker yesterday. But I think that if we are getting a blaxploitation version of Jolene, I think I needed it to go further, to be honest. It's in some respects too faithful to the original. Like, it really, I love the acrylic sound. You know, I love the harmonica, which we didn't know Stevie Wonder's playing. Sounds great. I like the sort of distorted voice in the beginning that's going like, Jolene. Like, I like that part, but then the rest of it is just Jolene. Like, give us the Shaft theme or something up in there, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. Like, give us something from Truck Turner. You know, where she's, I love that movie, Nichelle Nichols. Give us Pimp. Give us Superfly. Give us something else that feels like it is really just sort of going over the top, which she does with Spaghetti.
A song that starts off with a timestamp.
Right.
Just like referencing Thanos, a person I have not thought about nigh upon 5 years
no,
at this point.
The only person snapping here is me.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, the Thanos reference still hits me every time I listen to it, because it feels so, Beyonce rarely makes a reference that feels like I'm watching the pop culture that the kids are watching.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know? And this song, you know, starts out with Linda Martell,
who we should say is the first Black woman to sing at the Grand Ole Opry, who is featured on this album and has a little ditty to say about genres before we jump into another country song.
Mm-hmm. She's still with us,
yes.
by the way.
Yeah.
She is still alive.
Like 82 years old, yeah.
Yeah. And so she starts talking about how genre is sort of constricting and how people get trapped into genres and it doesn't help them really expand as an artist or show you everything that they're capable of. And then we get straight into a sort of country hip hop anthem, which has a great verse from Beyonce on it. It has a less memorable verse from a man named Shaboozy.
You said that damningly. Okay.
I turn it off after Beyonce's verse.
I'm happy for this man. He is a Nigerian American, sort of like alt country musician out of Virginia. I'm happy for him. I'm glad he's getting his shine.
He had two songs on this album.
Yeah. And guess what? The second one, that's a bop.
The second one is a bop. Sweet Honey Bucket.
Yes. But
this one, the I really feel like Spaghetti sort of flopped for me after Beyonce's verse. And then I'm sort of like, what are we doing with this song here? Before we get into Alligator Tears, where you were claiming that Protector is one of her best vocals. I'm sorry, honey, it's Alligator Tears. Alligator Tears is the all up in your mind.
I love this song.
This is probably my second favorite song on the album.
Yes. Yeah.
I think also, to me, it actually reminded me again of Fleetwood Mac. Like the guitar reminded me of The Chain, the suspenseful sort of drama of that song. And I will say, I think the thing I like most about that song, that feeling, that tension, is almost something I could have stood to hear more of on the album, like a little bit more danger sounding, even though we are getting a lot of violence, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I definitely felt that Lewis was going to like this song. I feel like
somebody else also said I knew Bodyguard was going to be your favorite, as if I was a dick for liking it. Yeah.
Well, no, I was feeling that you like Bodyguard and Alligator Tears too, because I just felt like whenever we talk about music on this show, you know, you and I obviously have very different major touchstones on like what we like to listen to, but I feel like the touchstones that we agree on, you know, very much female pop vocals of like the 70s and 80s, you know, very Fleetwood Mac heavy, you know, very funk heavy. I feel like Bodyguard and Alligator Tears are very positioned in like our Venn diagram of songs that we like.
Oh,
and
certainly.
The vocals on those two songs are so beautiful. I think my friend referred to Alligator Tears as sort of the all up in your mind of this album, in that it's sort of going to be very underrated, and you're only going to hear a few people talking about how much they love this song, but I can't wait till she performs that one.
It's going to be beautiful. I mean, the Alligator Tears is a song that will be performed at every wedding that I go to. That will be when everyone starts bringing out their violins, because I went to Oberlin, so I went to a conservatory. So everyone brings violins to weddings, and I tell you, that's going to be one that people are jamming out to.
I feel like we're going to get so many covers of this song.
Yes.
What are your feelings on Just for Fun?
I love it.
I love that song.
Another Ryan Beatty track. Just for Fun is, it's just beautiful. You're right. Right here, we were sort of in the beautiful, sweet part of the album. It starts out very didactic, then it gets violent, and then it gets a bit emotional before we start pussy popping, as Beyonce is wont to do.
Yes.
You know, the latter half of the album, once we get to Linda Martell's Show, it sort of feels like very much in line with Renaissance.
Yeah.
Right.
Which makes sense, as Renaissance was supposed to follow right into this, because I do think I think originally we were aiming for maybe like a chronological situation where we're starting in that early Americana, going into dance hall and dance music, and then ending, felt like we could end with like 70s, 80s rock. It is my thought.
I also want to say that this is the only regard in which I almost wish I had heard this album before Renaissance, because I feel like Renaissance created this universe of aliens and space travel, and we're bouncing between all these planets all the time, and it's a constant ride. Whereas this, I feel like you are bouncing around, but it's more like you're going between different patches on a quilt. And I just feel like the momentum is a little bit lesser on this, whereas Renaissance was confidently going in all directions at all times, whereas I feel like there's a few too many detours.
Well, you know, I feel like the whole road trip element of this album, you know, it feels like you're on Earth first and then you get into space,
because you end up at Area 51.
Yeah. Yeah, took a wrong turn at Albuquerque. Yeah.
Oh no,
yeah.
I think that's what the visuals are going to be.
The visuals of just the, you know, long road trip remind me of that canceled television version of Keep It that we had once, that we don't have to bring up, but right. It's supposed to be a road trip.
It's done been brought up, but yes, yeah, right. Yeah.
So then we have Two Most Wanted. Miley Cyrus is on it. The Thelma and Louise of it all, obviously. The Oh Brother, Where Art Thou elements of it. This is the song that people were predicting would be a Gaga feature when we just first saw the title of it. But I think it really works as a Miley song. Their voices sound great together, and I did not expect that.
I didn't either, and I think that is probably just a credit to whoever was engineering that. I salute them.
And also a very memorable hook. I just think it's a song you're immediately singing again once you hear it, even one time.
Yeah. My first reaction was, Harold, they're lesbians.
Your lips to God's ears. Would love that.
It is very sapphic. So her and Miley in that sort of video would be almost sort of like her Prisoner video with Dua Lipa, which is one of Miley's sexiest videos.
Luckily, she follows this up with something the opposite of sapphic, which is Post Malone on Levi's Jeans, a song I do really like.
I was going to say, watch your mouth. Talking about Austin Post? That's my man.
I love about her featuring Miley and Post Malone back to back that these are two people who have taken from Black culture at one point in their careers very visibly. And at the time, I think were rightfully ridiculed for it. And now she has taken them back in this reclamation of this genre. She has taken them back and been like, okay, now I'm going to use you and I'm going to get what I need out of you to refocus this genre where it should have been to begin with. And I think that is very poetic.
Exactly. She's the gander here. You know, like what was good for the geese. I love how you articulated that, because I feel like a lot of people were questioning why she was working with Miley and Post Malone because of their sort of history involving Black music. But I think it makes perfect sense in the thesis of the album and this sort of reclamation moment. And I do want to address the fact that a lot of people are concerned about the reclamation element of the album. It's like, why are you using sort of white rage to fuel your album? And I think that she is absolutely, you know, like, not everyone needs to be in this Toni Morrison space of, I'm writing my Black art and I'm ignoring everything that happens involving white people in my life. Because I'm sorry, it is a big moment, the fact that your CMA performance was scrubbed from the internet. You know, if anything, I feel like my main criticism with this album is that, and Doreen also pointed this out in her review, it's going to feel dated in its thesis, in the sense that she references, you know, the CMAs or something, like, I don't need those awards, etc. Like, I don't need the Grammys, everything. And it's Jay-Z has rapped about, like, we don't need the Grammys before of the Carters, and yet they showed up to the Grammys again just to have their faces played in again. They've referenced, we don't need the Super Bowl, and now Jay-Z is booking acts for the Super Bowl halftime show. It is this weird thing of saying, we don't need this, and having all of the, you know, sort of like attitude that comes with that only a year or two later to be in the thick of it.
That, I think that's a fair criticism. I was thinking a lot this weekend about, just because I love pettiness. I love that energy that earth signs do give out, being a Capricorn myself. And it is, for me, it's very funny now that Jay-Z showed up to the Grammys this year and said what he said, knowing that that woman was sitting on this album. It is, like, it is a very funny. And whether she wins Album of the Year or not, I am going to look back at that moment and chuckle.
My favorite album of all time is Harry's House, so I don't want to contribute to this. I'm kidding. So. And Adele's Remember 25. Him. The only two I bump. Huh?
I mean, on the Linda Bartel show, she opens it up with saying, those petty bitches have nothing on me because I'm a clever girl, which some people think is a reference to Clever Girl from Jurassic Park.
I would say
I
not.
I saw that. I don't
I would
think
say
so.
Not. I saw it on genius.com. And
I'm sorry. We had vocalists on this album. Vocalists. To the people who were thinking that she had Taylor Swift singing backgrounds on a Raphael Sadiq track.
Insanity. Oh. Insanity.
Insulting to all involved.
Also, yeah, you would hear Taylor Swift, I think. I mean, I know that. Anyway, it's a weird story.
The girls were editing just out of control.
I would say that, honestly, even in the thesis of Beyonce and Taylor and their friendship, too, you're not going to see Taylor Swift popping up on a Beyonce album, because Taylor's fans are insane and rabid. And they, first of all, even created a bodyguard Wikipedia page that immediately vanished once they discovered that it wasn't Taylor on the song. I don't think Beyonce, in all that she's doing, would want to attribute the success of her album to a Taylor feature at all.
No.
Meanwhile, Taylor is already assured in her dominance of white culture and the mainstream anyway. So Beyonce appearing on a song of hers would be a get for her. She'd be excited for it. You know, it wouldn't have the same sort of cultural effect and it wouldn't mean the same thing. Anyway, flamenco is a skip.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Yaya and, is sure not.
Woo!
Oh, yeah, for me, Yaya and Bodyguard are constantly tied for the best for me. Yaya for me was the, after having seen Renaissance and having and watching old videos of her during the B-Day era, where she was really just sort of like cutting up mm-hmm. on stage with the Sugar Mamas, her all-female band at the time. Yaya, even on first listen, was the song where I was imagining her on stage performing this. The song's about like 5 minutes now. I'm imagining when we get the live version of Yaya, it is a sort of 12-minute sprawling performance, sort of akin to what she was doing with Get Me Bodied at Homecoming. Mm-hmm. I just see like a lot of call and response to the audience, the band playing on for long, her just dancing up a storm on stage. This song is a masterpiece.
Oh, when they go from Yaya into Work It Out, I'm going to lose yes. my goddamn
yes.
mind.
I literally, even like there's something about the song Yaya where I'm thinking about how she looks in the Work It Out video.
Oh yeah.
You know,
it is Yaya is 100% Work It Out's like older, cool cousin yeah. come back from college.
And by the way, again, the Beach Boys moment in it where she references Good Vibration, almost puzzling. Almost puzzling.
Well, no, not puzzling to me because, again, not on the CD, not on the vinyl. And I do wonder if Yaya was supposed to be maybe the first or second track on Act 3, the rock album.
Yes, right. Again, yeah, there's yeah. so many rock influences here. You wonder what ends up getting subsumed into this album from the potential third.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The Beach Boys just hit me because that is like, that's another Venn diagram of my shit. The Beach Boys, Beyonce, and then Nancy Sinatra. Come on.
Now that I expect. Yeah, a little Nancy Sinatra on this album. Yeah, Beach Boys, I just want to say my favorite song of theirs, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, off Pet Sounds, A+. Anyway. All right, speed round, moving through the rest of the album. Love Two Hands to Heaven, love Tyrant. I wish Desert Eagle were a longer full song, because to me that has another thing we both love, which is the sound of Rufus and Chaka Khan on it, that like slap bassy sound. And it's like we could have used, I think, a moment of thick funk that was sustained on this album if we're going to be traveling through the 1970s anyway.
Yeah. I will say my one thought about Tyrant, the violin has not hit that hard since Miri Benari was still on tracks. I thought I was listening to John Legend's first album. I was like back in like, again, not to invoke him, but like first Kanye stuff.
Oh, right.
That violin, beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Desert Eagle for me is just, as soon as the beat drops on that song, I wanted more of it. And yes. I was so upset that it feels like an interlude. I appreciate Riverdance more
I enjoy
than
it.
I love it.
Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
I like the beat. But Two Hands to Heaven, Tyrant. Dolly Parton appearing again on Tyrant, doing her little ditty.
Yep.
And then Beyonce just getting black as hell, a little hood on the rest of the song is so funny to me. And Sweet Honey Buckin' is another one that just feels like, I mean, it's giving pure honey from the last.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. It's just giving you so much. I really feel like the back half of this album is so vibrant. And if Renaissance had come after it, it'd go straight into I'm That Girl.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, Church Girl could have been on this album.
Yeah. Oh, my God, of course.
Well, so that's the one thing that this album is like maybe missing is more gospel influence. That's like, that's the only, that's the one little thing that could have been thrown in there.
Yeah. If she's going to hit all these constellations of musical genres like this, like why not just include it? But you're right. Yeah. But again, these all are technically part of one act, these three albums. So maybe she did, as part of this one project, do that.
Yeah.
I would say letter grade for this.
Yeah.
For me, if Renaissance for me is an A, I would put this album at a B+.
Exactly what I would say.
Mm-hmm. For me, this is an AA- for me. It, as a woman who got her start in pop culture, writing about how I didn't understand why the show Supernatural in all of its creation of Americana and like its reference to folklore and the West, why that show eliminated Black people and like why there was no touching on Black and Brown Americana folklore, why we weren't involved in that. Like, this validates so many of my interests. And I just like, I feel like this album was written for me, for the girl who wears a gun trigger around her neck, for the girl who has a Jesse James memorabilia collection, for the horse girls. Like, this is my Beyonce album. This is it.
Exactly. And I feel like this album is going to grow with me over time, but it really feels like, yeah, the Beach Boys of it all, the funk of it all, the Rufus, Shaka, it just feels like it touches on, like I said earlier, that kid who would go to the record store, who would be shifting through the vinyls, who would pick something out based on the cover or the recommendation of the person who works there. This is her in her high fidelity record store, cool chick mode. And she's just, obviously she did this for Black people in a sense. But I think that, you know, talking about the reclamation of stuff is just sort of another way to box it in. And I feel like this album goes to great lengths to tell you not to box her in. And I feel like this is a bitch who loves music. Okay. And this album is for people who love music and love the weirdness of America and pop culture and this country and all the shit that it represents.
It has an amazing sense of time and place. And within that, it's a sense of where we've been and where we're going to go and where I've been in terms of location and where I'm going to go. So I just feel like it's like a crossroads, if you will. We're at the Delta again. Look at me. I'm a musicology professor. Now I work at Oberlin.
All right. When we are back, Justice Smith.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians, and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
we still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians, and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
we still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Our guest today is always one of the best parts of anything he's in. You know him from his affable charm in the Jurassic World movies Detective Pikachu, Dungeons & Dragons, Generation, and his new movie, The American Society of Magical Negroes. You can see him next in A24's upcoming and apparently frigging amazing I Saw the TV Glow out May 3rd. We are delighted to welcome to Keep It the dynamic and captivating Justice Smith. And you're Hello. In studio.
Yes, I'm here. I don't like speaking over a screen. Not to call you out, Ira.
I'm offending you now. I was literally in LA last week in studio with Lewis, a first in years.
I should have come in then.
Yeah. I want to say this movie that you're in, the American Society of Magical Negroes, what I love about you is you've always had such this great just sort of candor about you as an actor, which I feel like a lot of people don't have or try and shy away from. And I feel like you, even on your Instagram, you have embraced the fact that people have a lot of thoughts about this movie. They had a lot of thoughts from the trailer, and now they've had a lot of thoughts now that it is out. How do you, I guess, deal with the conversation surrounding a movie like this? And did you anticipate that it was going to be this hot a topic while you were making it?
Not as hot as it is. I knew that there was going to be... I knew it was controversial to an extent. I didn't know that the initial concept, like the like base concept was going to be so hard for people to like grasp. Like this, first off, explaining what a magical Negro was, explaining that trope to everybody was like a chore within itself. And then kind of introducing this metaphor for like the ways Black people have to navigate white society. Again, I thought we all had an understanding like, yeah, the code switching is real. Like this is just kind of like a funny metaphor for that. But that really like shook people up. And then on top of that, there's like the interracial love story. There's like my casting, which I was like more prepared for in terms of controversy. But I will say I've been on like a really long spiritual journey with this movie because it was one that I had so like such a big hand in, like I loved so much and I felt like was my story. And like, you know, I had always wanted to do a movie about race because I'm Black and race is a big part of my life. And but like a lot of the scripts I would be sent, I'm like, okay, well, this isn't my specific experience, so I don't feel like I can lend myself to. But with American Society, I was like, I get this. I grew up in a very white environment. Like, I compromised myself in so many different ways. I grew up in Orange County, California.
Oh,
yes. Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
The guttural reaction. Yes, you know what I mean?
I have driven through it. Yes. I have driven through it. Yeah.
So
it's not the OC.
No.
No, not at all. So I got that. I was like, I feel like I can lend myself to this character. And then having such a strong reaction from Twitter was like, okay, that's fine. From like Fox News or Breitbart, I was like, if anything, that's great press. Like, I love that. But then like Black Twitter, like that really kind of bummed me out. Cause I was like, damn, like you never want to upset the people that you love. And then I was like, okay, but when the movie comes out and they see it, they're going to love it even more. But then like critics bashed it. Like no one went to go see it. I mean, like, the people who did loved it, but a lot of that Twitter backlash kind of fucked us. Can I swear?
You sure can.
Fucked You're us in the enough. Fucking ass.
Yeah.
and I really had I was at a fork in the road where I was like, how can I respond to this? I want to respond to it with humor, you know, even though there was like the initial pain. And also it taught me so much about like who I am. Knowing what I'm fighting for, and knowing who I am as an artist. So, like, when people were saying things online or whatever, just, like, that's okay. You guys can have your opinions. That's completely fine and valid. And some of your opinions are valid. And I don't have to defend myself necessarily.
And you said also that you've had an entire journey when it comes to doing press for movies in general, like liking the process of doing press or, like, finding a way to find joy in promoting things when conversations can end up, as you just said, all over the internet or strange or whatever. How have you made talking about movies something you enjoy doing?
I find that, okay, so my metaphor, my analogy that I always use is people who work with animals don't like scooping up shit, but they scoop up shit so that they can continue to do what they love. And press for me is the scooping up of shit of acting.
You hear that, Ira?
Every time I say that in an interview, the person that I'm speaking to is like, I don't know how to take that. I don't know how to receive that. But I actually, you know, that's kind of how I got into like just being like, okay, let me suck it up and do this. But now I kind of like it because I like talking to people. I like meeting new people. And I try to have fun with it. I don't know. I don't really know how to answer that question because it's not... It's just something that I kind of worked on doing, having fun.
Yeah.
I worked on having fun in press situations. And so it just started coming more naturally.
You know what I have to say, though, is like, in a way, you feel to me like a rad critic. Like, in another life, you could be somebody who's just like talking about movies as opposed to starring in them. Did you ever have any ambitions to be that kind of commentator?
No.
Really?
I personally feel like critics should have like some hand or some experience in like filmmaking or like, you know, the industry to like some extent, because I feel like this like objective, like I just love movies. And so I have a right to a voice and a right to an opinion. I feel like it's just, it creates a jaded individual when you don't know how much effort goes into like making a film, getting a film made. Not to say like we should get brownie points because we made a thing, but I just feel like it would provide a different perspective. If I were to ever become a reviewer, I think I would have more of an ethical standing.
A little
standing.
More restraint, yeah.
Yeah, then like more credibility, I guess, because I know what it means to make a film.
Can I tell you something, though, as somebody who's never made a movie in his life? It is so much fun to opine about them and not know a fucking thing. I have to say.
You know what goes into the process.
Oh, I mean, like I've seen a camera before, et cetera, but yeah.
I also think, yeah, but you know, in that same vein, listen, I have a lot of contradicting opinions. In that same vein, I think that like good art doesn't show, you don't see the work. Like you shouldn't see, you know, like the equations on the side of the paper. You should just like see the answer, you know? So I feel like if audiences are watching your thing and it's not connecting them, and then you want to like, but I put so much work in it. I think that's bullshit. Again, it's like you don't get brownie points for effort.
We're so far removed, I guess, from film. You know, even if you make films, even if you make television, you are not actually there on set. So like, there's still sort of this removal from the process. But you've done theater, and you've done. Would love to talk about that. You did this play, The Mother, with Isabelle Huppert,
Whoa.
Icon.
Yeah.
But for me, as a person who has worked in theater, the brownie points thing, you, no matter how hard you know people are working, like I can go see, I hate it, Moulin Rouge on Broadway, you know? And you go and see it and you can see the sweat on these dancers.
Yeah.
You know how hard they're fucking working. But then you can also still leave it and say, I hated that. And yeah. Why was, you know, it made. And so there is always this disconnect between that. But how do you feel about the theatrical process, I guess, then, as opposed to the film process?
Pros and cons on either side. It has, like, a very special place in my heart, theater, because I grew up doing theater. Like, when I was studying acting, it was, like, to be in theater. It wasn't necessarily, like, film acting. So I learned everything I know from theater, and it's also the actor's medium. You know, they say film is the director's medium, TV is the writer's medium, but with theater, it's like once that curtain goes up, I'm completely in control. Yeah, I have my notes, I have my script, but like the audience's experience is completely shepherded by me, and that makes me feel the most autonomous as an actor, because I put work into this thing, you know, and into like this craft of being an actor. But I have like, I have good ideas, you know, like when it comes to my performances and when it comes to film and TV, you know, it's really left in the hands of like the director. Like if the director has a strong vision and how they're going to edit your performance, or, you know, where the, like in television, where they want to, like the writers want to take your character over the season. So you have less control. And I'm not like faulting the film and television experience, because I love it for its own reasons. You know, theater, you have to hammer out the same story every single night for months on end. And film and TV, you can just like, you just have to get it once. And then it's like in the can. But I mean, yeah, those are the kind of like the pros and pros and cons. But I love theater. I always want to return to theater. And we were just talking about theater.
Oh, yes, because we both saw Appropriate. Starring Sarah Paulson, who, by the way, is just fully Laurie Metcalf now. Like, you remember Sarah Paulson? That's gone. It's Laurie Metcalf. And in Scream 2. Yeah.
I agree with that. She's incredible in that.
She's awesome in the play.
I love that playwright, too.
Jacob Jenkins.
Yes. He's incredible. I don't know if you saw the comeuppance. Did you see that?
Do you see that?
No, I saw the Octoroon.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't see the Octoroon. I want to work with him Octoroon. So bad.
Yeah, but the awesome thing about that play is it sort of at the beginning feels like a string of theatrical cliches, like a God of Carnage or Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, where people are having arguments where they say things like, "And you're making it all about yourself again." And then you realize it's more of this secret zone of interest type movie where it's about what they're not discussing and something that's happening alongside the play that is very interesting and recontextualizes these boring arguments they're having. It's a very, very good play.
Yes, it's so good. It's also like the first play. I mean, maybe there's a... I guess zone of interest is kind of in that same vein where it's like it's a play about race that only like features white people.
Yes.
Which I thought was like... Like, it's an art piece within itself, because even watching the play, with a predominantly white audience, like, the things that the white people were laughing at and the things that, like, me and my partner were laughing at were, like, completely different things. Like, the things that gagged us were like, oh, shit, like, that's terrible. And the white people were like, oh, we're so kooky. Yeah. I'm like, I feel like this is a commentary in itself.
Yes, totally.
You know, like, so it was just like, beautiful all around.
But we must say, we've now brought up Sarah Paulson, but to get back to Isabelle Huppert, finally.
Mm-hmm.
When she was here on this podcast, we were, like, intimidated initially.
Wait,
we
didn't know, had her on?
We sure did a couple years ago.
Yeah. Incredible. This is a place for icons.
Yeah.
Okay?
She's incredible.
So, welcome.
We were scared initially. And then it turns out, if you know what you're talking about, she, like, loves you. And then, but her vibe was, you know, she's not method at all. She's very instinctive and then seemingly just does the job when she's on a movie set. What is it like working with her, who I maybe has done the most acting of any human being over the past 50 years.
Yeah, absolutely. She has this thing when we were doing press for Mother, she talked about, she's like, "I don't play characters, I play states of
she
being."
She said the same thing to us.
I stole that from her because I was like, I so connect with that. It's like, it's not like a mountain that I'm climbing to like create a character. It's like, it's something that I'm mining from within myself. And like, she does that so effortlessly where she's just like, she hops in and hops out. She also, like, I speak French, and so she would, like, give me little notes in French. Like, she'd be like, "Get out of my light. Like, you're standing, like, just move a little bit to the side." So, like, the director wouldn't know that she was, like, directing me. But
fuck yeah.
I also, like got so good at French, like, speaking with her. But I really felt, she's just, like, so, I mean, such an incredible artist, and also, like, really maternal. And I don't know if that's just because of the roles that we were playing, because I was playing her son. But she has, like, this real, like she loves young actors. Like, she's, like, there to support young actors. And it's just so bold and, like, the choices that she makes. And it's like, when she plays a role, it's, like, she does it. You're like, is that? Like, I've never seen a human express emotion in that way. But it, like, makes so much sense to me. Like, you saw Piano
Oh, my
teacher?
God, yes.
Like, when she's at, I mean... That expression on her face, I was like, I would have never thought to, like, if I were stabbing myself, like, that's kind of what would come out of my body. But, like, her, it's just, like, the way she feels is so unique. She's, like, having her own human experience.
No, she, like, the way she, like, her spectrum is, like, she has this, like, stony hauteur, and then suddenly the bizarre will occur.
Yes.
And yet they both feel organic to each other.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, you worded it better than I ever could, but... She's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I love her dearly.
You know, I want to ask a bit about, you talked about seeing the play with your partner and being shocked about it. I want to ask about sort of performance in general. You talked about with American society about not wanting to upset the people you love, not upsetting like Black Twitter or something. Do you sometimes feel like even your own self when you're not acting has to be a bit of a performing to, I guess, what your audience is? I'm asking this in particular because I feel like, you know, when you were dating your partner at first, there's a lot of just posts online about you in general, about the fact that
you had
a Black partner, about the fact that, you know, you were representing Black love in general.
Oh, lots that's of threads what they were about saying?
It. Yes, there was a lot of threads about it.
I wish I saw that.
You didn't see any of those? There's this whole thread from writer Mikkel Street about both of you, about how like it was a shrine to your black love. There's a whole article on Extra Magazine about it. I don't know. Did you ever? Well, you didn't see any of that. I was about to ask if you felt like that was something that you felt you needed to present to the world as a black queer actor.
That article, if I think it's the right article, that one I did see where he talks about how much like us being public meant to him, like because he had never seen like public, like a black queer couple that was like public in that way or something. I don't know. But that was beautiful. Yeah, I saw that one. It's a difficult thing to navigate because, being a public figure to any extent is not really natural. You know, like you're like exposed to the public in these like short bursts where you kind of have to like show your multitudes like within like these like 30-second sound bites. And then like the public metabolizes it and they make their opinions about who you are as a person based off of these like short bursts of you, but they don't see like the ins and outs of you daily. And so it's kind of like this difficult thing where you're like, I understand how important publicity is, especially to my career, because like the more relatable I seem, the more it helps me, like literally helps me get jobs, you know, because it builds my profile, which makes me more marketable or more like lucrative to like studios or whatever. So it's like, it's kind of this like, it's kind of like the scooping up shit of like, how do I really like find a way to present myself authentically in the public eye in these kind of, in these like limited moments that like allow me to have some privacy and some integrity, but also allow people like in to my life so that they can connect to my like art even more. You know what I mean? Like, it's like it's a really difficult thing to balance. I wouldn't say that I have all the answers right now, but like, I just try to like live in the moment and try to like be as authentic as possible. And I think the whole like inviting people into my relationship was like the base level of authenticity I could offer the public, because like we can really get into like the way that like, you know, the public digests queerness, you know, and or like when an actor or a singer or a quote-unquote celebrity like comes out, it's just like it becomes like such a brand. And I'm like, like, queerness is, like, at least in my life, it's so normal. Like, it's like, that is, like, not how I brand the people in my life. It's like, oh, yeah, they're queer. And, like, that's, like, the main kind of, like, talking point about them. Maybe then that's just because I'm surrounded by so many queer people in my personal life. But it's just interesting that that becomes, like, such a, like, a moniker for, like, celebrities.
But I have that many queer people in my life, but I do, when I say hi to them, address them as queer initially. So it's like a little about.
I feel like it's slowly changing as more people come out, you know? There's like more roles for like queer actors, which is really cool. And like queer actors are playing straight roles, which is really cool. And so it's, and also like, I feel like a lot of the reaction of like, oh, this person is out, like this person is queer, is like from queer community being like, oh, I feel safe now, or like I'm like more interested in like this actor or this singer or whatever, because like I see myself in them more, I relate to them more. And that I like. It's like, you know, that is kind of like a cool connective tissue between audiences and public figures.
I think the last stone to be unturned in this regard is when we get a Stanley Tucci biopic, it should be a gay actor. You know what I'm saying? Then we will have made
yes.
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally.
Absolutely.
Now, okay, before we let you go, I have to ask about...
No,
we're not done yet. I have to ask about I Saw the TV Glow.
Okay.
Because the reviews coming out of Sundance for this were so extreme.
Yeah.
My friend Richard Lawson, who is the most cynical man alive, I say this lovingly, who writes for Vanity Fair, it was his favorite of the whole festival. What is it like to get that kind of attention, and were you expecting it?
Yeah, that film is incredible. When I read that script, I was like, I have no idea what the fuck I just read, and I have to do this movie, because it was just incredibly unique and singular. And I don't know if you saw We're All Going to the World's Fair.
Yes.
But like, Jane has this way of creating films that like get under your skin, where you're like, I'm not this girl online doing all this fucked up shit, but like I am in a way. I am her. You know, that it is my teen. I don't know. Like, it's like this weird, like Jane creates feelings. Like I just, you know, like really fucking dark, creepy, crawly feelings. And I think I Saw the TV Glow is like in that same vein of just like getting under people's skin. And even if they don't understand it logically, like what's happening, they like feel it viscerally. There were so many people who I talked to after Sundance who saw the movie where I was like, oh, did you like the part where this and this and this happened? And they're like, oh, that's what that meant? But like, who were like telling me they loved it and like it was incredible. And so I'm like asking what they loved about it. And they're just like, it's like a vibe, you know?
And I can only hope for more Danielle Deadwyler in my life too.
She's phenomenal. Another amazing,
she's like an abnormal talent.
Talent.
She's an abnormal talent. She's an amazing actor.
I mean, she's obviously she's blowing up, but like I can't wait for like her really to like hit the stratosphere because she's incredible. And she's also, her personality is phenomenal. Like she's kind of like just askew. Like, and like, I love people like that because you talk to her and it's just like she lives in her own world. And I think that's why she's such an incredible artist. Just like Isabelle Huppert. It's like the way she like feels feelings is so unique. And like, that's why you're like captivated by her. And she's like always doing something different on screen. But.
No, it's like if I ever like were eye to eye with Mary Louise Parker, I know I would see something off. You know what I mean? You want that in like a genius actor.
Right,
you know?
Right, right. Yeah. Very true. Yeah.
You should have saw the seagull, okay?
I know.
She was just staring right at you. Ugh. There was a adaptation of the seagull that was done starring her and Hari Neff and some other people.
Whoa.
It was pretty
good. I wanted to see that.
It was great. It was a modern adaptation of it.
That's
but
sick.
It was really, really good. And thank you for being here. I mean, I really have to commend you. I love the shoveling shit metaphor, and I feel like I get that from you, especially because you have been so likable in so many blockbuster movies that I really enjoy, though. But, I mean, for a young actor, you when you think about the movies you've been in, you know, Jurassic World, Detective Pikachu, I mean, like, you have done the brunt of, I am promoting a movie, I am at junkets, this is constantly my day. So I get it.
I feel like I, like, subtly shaded both of you guys, like, throughout this thing.
Imagine not subtly shading us.
I mean, yes, of course. Also, don't worry about being humble here. I know you were born August 9th. We are three Leos on a podcast.
This is all
us. Wait, you guys are Leos?
Duh.
Yeah.
Oh, you couldn't tell immediately? You must not be that kind of Leo.
Wait, okay, but then I feel extra bad. Like, I really wasn't trying to shade you. Because I literally said, I'm like, oh my God, press is shoveling shit. I said, like, if you've never worked on a set, like, you can't, like, have opinions about movies and TV and stuff like that. Have you guys worked on sets before?
I'm a writer for Jimmy Kimmel Live and the Academy Awards.
Okay.
Nothing else, though.
Yeah, I'm a TV writer and producer.
So that one isn't shady at all. So that one you didn't receive as shit.
Just people who are outside the room suck. Yes, we agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love you blushing. I saw the actor glow. Look at him. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't shade you guys. Okay.
Thank you for being here.
Absolutely.
Sorry it's not longer.
I know. I was just getting into it.
Danielle Brooks told us the same thing. She was like, I got more shit to say.
Yeah. I have way more shit to say, but...
So you got to come back.
Next time.
For your next project.
You'll be co-hosting the episode next time.
Love
so we'll
that.
Have the whole time.
Love that.
And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis?
Yes.
What you got to say? What's on your mind?
So much. As you know, I'm burdened by these thoughts I carry, but I bring them to Keep It. Unfortunately, I saw TikTok again. And you know, that means we're already at an intellectual deficit. But somebody on TikTok made the comment, am I the only person who's ever noticed? First of all, stop right there. Because no. Stop pretending you're the first person to notice. Stop. Am I the only person who's ever noticed that SNL has never hired a, like, hot woman? Okay. I mean, first of all, what is the point of that TikTok? You want people in your face arguing that somebody is hot? Because, by the way, that's what people fucking did. So now there's, like, a list of screenshots being like, can't you see she's hot? Or whatever. Lorraine Newman, what a sexy woman. This is not helping this situation. We're not arguing for anything other than saying there's validity to being dismissive over very talented people because they don't look a certain way. I don't know. It's like, and I think this is like this, the person who posted this happens to be a woman of color. So it feels more like valid cultural criticism than what it is, which is a load of shit that nobody needs to interact with. but I just want to say, are people under the impression that like SNL is full of like extremely hot men or something. Like, what is the point of posting this? I just found it to be an extremely kind of toxic idea that people thought they could respond to and turn it into some beneficial thing for all of us. But I just found it to be mean, and that's it. Being mean is not a point of view. Or pardon me, it is a point of view, just not one I want to hear. Sorry, I haven't thought about my own point of view yet.
You know, it's giving rage bait.
Yeah, rage bait.
It's giving, I want you to get mad. I want you to respond. I want the TikTok views. It's very much the same way that there's always a wayward Gen Z gay tweeting something about how open relationships suck. We fought for equality just to get to open relationships. Or the one I saw yesterday that said, from the same person who has tweeted this before too, I can't believe gays make out in public. That's so gross. Like, it's giving IRL Grindr.
Excuse me? I can't go to a baseball game without seeing straight people make out. Which, I'm just going to say, nothing really erotic about that sport for me.
First of all, sitting down to make that TikTok is loser behavior. Even if it is for rage bait, I cannot get past the point of you look stupid. So it's like, am I going to come to the rest of your content?
Also, am I the only one who's noticed? What does that mean? Like, you sat on the Wikipedia, went through the like photo file of every SNL star, and you said 0% hot.
Also, I don't really want to qualify it with a actual response and, you know, get into the debating of, you know, whether or not there's been hot women on SNL and the hotness of them.
It was annoying to see Tina Fey trending because of this.
Right.
Yes.
But like, everyone is ignoring the hottest woman who is currently on SNL right now, and it's Colin Jost.
No, that is a lady. Yes. Let's talk about posture.
His porcelain good looks.
Yes, yes, yes. Ira, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it goes to maybe myself.
Finally, thank God, my life, my prayers. Yes. Go ahead.
Myself and the rest of the internet for making me think that the Gag City World Tour was going to be abominable. But I saw Nicki Minaj on Saturday night at Madison Square Garden, and she killed.
Really?
She was so fucking good. And the show was fantastic. I know that the show was thrown together very quickly, which can happen, you know? I mean, I don't know if she was planning to really do a big, massive tour in this sort of manner, but man, I was impressed. And I'm a concert goer. Like, I've seen so many random pop stars' concerts that are giving less of what Nicki is giving here. And I think that what's really great about this is fans have been starved for it. You know, she's mostly been doing Rolling Loud and other sort of festivals for years and not really giving the Barbs, me, like a tour. And so I remember the Nicki Hendrix tour, which was supposed to happen, and that got canceled. I wore to the concert my Nicki Hendrix sweater that I bought when that concert was initially canceled, because I was like, well, let me get this merch because it is going to be valuable in the future. And not like I'd ever sell it, but it's nice to wear and it's nice to see people recognize what it is when I'm wearing it. Finally getting to see Nicki live was just amazing. And the energy of everyone in the room, whatever you think of the Barbs online, and there's a lot to say about them.
Well, that is where they live. Yeah.
The people in the concert was a mix of younger fans, gays I knew in the city, older people, to be honest, older people who just sort of like love her music and love hip hop. And everyone was singing along to every song. Even if some people didn't know the newer songs, they knew sort of like songs from 5 years ago. Everyone was singing along to like the Pink Friday songs, like the Roman Reloaded songs, the Pink Print songs. It was just really an amalgamation of a lot of people from different cultures, races, ages.
I feel like a criticism people have had of her live is she's holding the mic up to the audience too much.
Yes. And that is, I mean, listen, it can happen. You know, she will be rapping and then she'll be like, You know, first things first, I and I'm a keep. But she was doing a bit less of that than I was seeing on TikTok of the earlier shows. So maybe she's taken some of that criticism. But I also think it makes sense for her to do that because the audience was truly rapping along to every word.
They screamed to Nicki Minaj songs. Yes, they ruined their voice rapping along. Yeah.
It felt completely communal. I was on the floor of Madison Square Garden and people were standing in their chairs so they could just see it better. It was such a fun communal experience. And if that could be everyone's sort of experience of the Barbs, I think that the view of the fan base would be better off.
Yeah, I have to agree. I will prioritize that in the future, I think. It's good to know that Gag City has some infrastructure now.
You know what? Customs was a breeze at Gag City. And that's why I have global entry.
Okay. Oh, I see. Just for that? Wow.
Yeah. I have global entry. My global entry appointment was when I arrived in Gag City. You know, just 5 minutes. And,
oh. Wow. Quick photo. Yeah, et cetera. Quick gag.
All right. Thank you to Justice Smith for being here this week. Thank you to Kendra James also for hopping on with us to talk Beyonce. I mean, how could we not let Kendra in the studio? She was coming in the studio either way.
Yeah. No. She had a lasso in hand, ripping open the door with it.
She was giving Denzel Washington, I'm leaving here with something. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are Chris Lord and CJ Siege Polkinghorn. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James. Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Shang, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroot, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians, and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.